Good afternoon again, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Welcome to another episode. With this episode, we are recording episode 239, I believe, and are recording today. I think that's the fifth episode today. So, and we got a few podcast edits to do on the weekend, and hopefully we'll push out a few more episodes to, you know, make them live next week, early in the week. So I want to thank you all for joining me today. I want to thank the audience for tuning in for this particular episode. It's a very interesting one. My guest of honor, Jeffrey Fiddleman from New York. He is the founder and CEO of Fiddleman Company. And we're going to get to know Jeffrey a little bit. Before I get started, Jeffrey, everybody gets the easy one. First question, the story question. If you don't mind, take us through your journey. What's your story? What got you here, if you don't mind? Welcome to the channel, by the way.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Robin. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here with you.
Same here.
Talking about what I talk about on this podcast, off this podcast, both before and afterwards around fundraising. So I'm happy to join here and talk more about it. My journey is, I mean, hindsight being 2020 is relatively simple and straightforward, although it did not seem at all that way while I was on the journey. I still am, but kind of on what led me here. And my journey predominantly has been in finance. After school, I spent better part of a decade between Morgan Stanley, then HSBC, where I really was more focused on institutional fundraising and investment banking. And while I was at HSBC, I was recruited by a family office to help them run a venture fund. And that's kind of when I went from corporate institutional world into a venture fund. It was under a single family office, a really clean organizational structure. I was a partner there. And the focus of that venture fund was investing in early stage tech and tech-enabled companies. And more so, the thesis was that we would anchor an early round and then help the founders syndicate the rest of the capital, go out and raise the rest of the capital. And while I was there, I was constantly comparing what I had been doing at the institutions to what these companies were doing now in terms of having a structure or having a consistency or having some sort of programmatic approach to raising capital. And I didn't really see that time and time again. And that's kind of where this white space was illuminated to me, that early stage companies have almost a harder time raising capital because they're earlier stage, higher risk, less revenue, if any revenue. Although raising less money, it's almost easier to fund $10 or $100 million because that money is going into an operating business with history, with management team, with basically, you know, de-risked, so to speak, whereas the earlier stage company is not. So being that it's harder, structure is materially even more important at that stage than it is in later stage companies. So in 2015, after spending about a year or two with the VC, I ended up leaving and ultimately building what has now become, over the past 11 years, an investment bank focused on early stage companies. And more recently, we have been working with a lot of fund managers as well, both VC and private equity. And the structured approach is what had been on my mind the entire time in trying to figure out the solution to bring an institutional practice to the non-institutional world, right? How we thought about raising capital at an institution, but applying that same structure and methodology to companies that were historically managing their fundraise on a spreadsheet or on a Trello board, or maybe on a written documentation or in a book somewhere that they were just tossing aside and updating whenever they felt like it or had time to do it. And that's really what fundraise as a service is, at least how we approach it and how we offer it. I always jokingly say that nothing we do is proprietary. It's simply taking best practices that you can Google or ChatGPT or XYZ AI of choice that anybody uses and say, like, how do I raise capital properly? Almost every platform or any Google search or whatever platform you search will always say that you build a list of investors, you make sure you qualify them, you make sure you personalize the outreach, you do the outreach, and then you have constant and consistent kind of feedback loops, whether it's a newsletter and touch points and understanding what they're looking for, going back to building a new investor list and doing it all over again. So that's really what we ended up building. I'm happy to get into that more later on the pod, but that's really what we ended up building. We built it as a managed service. And really what that means is we went out and built the infrastructure for investment relations or raising capital. And then we simply rent that to our clients month to month so that there's no long-term commitment. There's no exclusivity. We try to remove as many barriers as possible to enable our clients to successfully get in front of qualified and interested investors.
Jeffrey, is this what you called Fund X?
So Fund X is something that we had been working on for several years. It's effectively the operating system that all of our analysts use today. So when I talk about built the infrastructure, subscribe to all these databases, then we layer an analyst on top of it to do all the work, we realize that even earlier stage companies still have the same need. So what Fundex is first we built it for ourselves, for that analyst to sit on top of Fundex to operate the managed service. And now we're spinning that out as a separate software that we'll peel the analyst back, which is the majority of our cost, and just supply that same infrastructure to our clients so that they can sit on the platform and do their own fundraise.
And for the localization gang out there who's listening to this podcast, I want to mention one most important thing is about Jeffrey, which we probably missed in the introduction. Jeffrey is a Harvard grad. And by the way, from the localization point of view, he speaks English, Russian, and American Sign Language. And I think he is the most multilingual banker I ever had on this podcast. So, you know, you earn the title, Jeffrey. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Multilingual bankers in New York. I don't know there's many of them. I think maybe there are a few, but with your qualification, it's very impressive.
Thank you. No, appreciate it. And sign language was one of those things where I already had a few languages in hand and I wanted to take it easy in high school. So that was what I chose. And believe it or not, it's come in handy quite a few times.
I would imagine it's a skill. And like any other skill, you need to learn, you need to practice, you need to enhance as you go along. Now, you know, you're from Long Island originally. Did I get that right?
From Long Island originally.
So, and you worked like for, you know, prestigious financial institutions, you know, HSBC and the likes, and Morgan Stanley, that's another big one too. So what changed in your view, how you view these large institutions to make you decide, say, you know what, I'm going to move from that. And I want to get to more, entrepreneurial way of doing capital raising or fundraising in that sense. Because the way you described it earlier, you went like to a smaller sort of boutique-ish kind of a family-owned way of managing nine-figure fund out there to employ that fund in startups. I have my views on large corporations, and I'm interested in your views as well, if you don't mind, to go from that large conglomerate to a smaller boutique. What changed and were you happy? Did you want to change anything in the process?
Yeah, well, look, first thing I'll say is fundraising was never the goal or the plan. It was certainly something where I was in a production role at the banks and I really didn't like it because of, yeah, sure, the pressures. I mean, I was successful in doing it, but it was, you're only as good as your last sale, right? Famous words. And I've always had this entrepreneurial itch. I mean, there's stories about me in middle school getting in trouble for reselling pizzas on the cafeteria line, to building my first real estate business before I graduated college. And I was going back and forth from Boston to New York, running that real estate business. And then I ultimately sold it. I always wanted something of my own. And frankly, I grew up that way. My parents were immigrants from Soviet Union. My dad started the business. He had a body shop. And it was always kind of impressed upon me that you want to be in control of your own destiny. And really the only way to do that is by owning your own business and managing and owning your own, whether it's income, economics, or your own destiny, as I said. And, you know, it's kind of, the grass is always greener on the other side. You have a job, you have a steady paycheck, you don't have to worry about it. You're done at 5 o'clock, you start at 9 o'clock, and the hours outside are family time or leisure time or hobby time, the weekends you don't worry about. Meanwhile, you start your own business. And the joke is that every one of your clients is a boss. You have 100 bosses, not just one. And you do end up working, you know, past 9 to 5 or before 9 and after 5 and working on the weekends. And something I, you know, 11 years into it, I still practice all those things, but I love it. I love it because I genuinely love what I do now. And I think I was missing for quite a long time the intellectual stimulation of speaking with different founders, different businesses. I mean, to tell you what my day looks like on a daily basis, I'll go from speaking with a skincare company raising $5 million to a rocket ship company raising $100 million to a quantum technology fund raising $200 million. And then all the way back down to a, let's call it a clothing fitting company raising $3 million and like over and over and back and forth again. And every hour, and not every moment, but every hour of my life is filled with this intellectual stimulation of different businesses and figuring out how they work and talking with the founders, not only about their fundraise, but I'm genuinely, and I think this is, I was talking to my colleagues before, and I think everyone has a superpower, or certainly entrepreneurs do at some point in time. I think mine is curiosity. And when I speak with founders, even before they become clients and speaking with people about their businesses, it's not so much of a sale to me. Sometimes I go way over time on a call with someone because I'm genuinely curious about, like, well, how do you make this rocket ship go into space? Or what is kind of the IP around the formulation, around the skincare product that makes it unique? Or how are you doing this measurement technology? Or how are you doing the space communication technology, right? I'm genuinely curious. And it's not for even personal, like, financial gain. It's more out of intellectual stimulation, as I said before. And that's what I gain from speaking with a lot of our clients.
Yeah.
And now, fast forward, I've been doing this for so long that I've seen a variety of permutations of what could go right and what could go wrong. And I think that's really a great deal of value that I ultimately add to our clients, because, you know, it's expertise versus experience. I'm kind of crossing the threshold now to talk about my experience above and beyond my expertise.
Now, obviously, Morgan Stanley and the rest of those large organizations that you work for have their own cadence. They have their own training programs. They've got their own how-to kind of thing. It must have taught you something. Did any of this training that you gained in those organizations got transferred with you to the new, I want to call it era?
Absolutely. You know, I my first day at Morgan Stanley, everyone spoke English, talking about multilingual. I couldn't understand a word that they were saying. You know, they were talking about yield curves and credit swaps. They were talking about what happens with an IPO. We were working on the Facebook IPO when I was there, and FireEye and a few others. And I was lost. This is after I sold my first business. I had a good amount of kind of intellect, or so I thought. This is after college also. And just the level of intellectual capital that was at Morgan Stanley was second to none. I mean, I learned so much about not only about financial markets, but also about how to deal with clients and how to act with different types of clients. I mean, they literally, when our training program, put us in a room, they hired actors. They had like three video cameras on my face, on their face, on us, and body language. And then it was a cohort of, it had to be more than 50. It was probably 100, 150 people. After the whole day, the next day, you sat in a room and they played every single person's interaction with these actors and would like nitpick on what you did right and what you did wrong. And of course, it was I had so much anxiety around it. It was super embarrassing. But then you sit there and you understand that like everyone sitting shoulder to shoulder with you is going through the same thing. And they're doing it to help you, to make you better. And it's not to, you know, degrade or to moralize or anything. It's the opposite. So, you know, Morgan Stanley definitely gave me a level of sophistication that I definitely did not have going into it. And HSBC was a little bit of a different situation because you go from institutional investment bank to more of an institutional retail bank. And in HSBC, my role was a lot more corporate in terms of what I did day to day. And that really taught me a lot more about management. Morgan Stanley, yes, of course, I had a manager and a manager's manager and so on and so forth and kind of bureaucratic environment. Yep. But it was production type of role, and the types of situations that we were dealing with were quite different than going to a retail bank, still bureaucratic, you know, still had managers, manager, et cetera, et cetera. But the actual day-to-day put me into a position of actually managing a great deal of people. That was a little bit weird because I was very young at the time, and I had people that I was managing that were, in some cases, 2+ times older than I was. So you can imagine what the dynamic was there. So that really taught me kind of how to sit into that role and how to manage people effectively, how to delegate and how to be political about the things that I wanted to accomplish without necessarily being just blunt out and saying it to people like that. So I think that both of those institutions had a significant impact on me, on the way that I handle myself, on the way that I approach different types of, whether it's issues or successes within a business. And I can sit here and honestly say I'm very grateful for the experience that I gained at both of those.
Of course. I mean, experience.
But, and I hate saying, but it didn't allow me to be entrepreneurial. And that's the itch. Well,
and you always felt that was missing, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I've worked all my life in a corporate environment. And I felt like up till November, like 2025, I felt like, you know, like I was high, you know, I was under a rock somewhere and I left the corporation and I felt like freed, I guess, from the shackles of red tapes, whatever else comes with corporate policies or corporate structures. Now, your core thesis, you know, when talking about productizing trust, is that traditional advisors are misaligned because they protect investors' relationships across multiple clients, while their economics rewards, like I'm guessing, like almost like a sales environment, rewards closing any deal, not the right deal. So in your practice right now, you took the most relationship-driven business in the world, fundraising. It's relationship business. and turn it into a repeatable process. Now, in your opinion, what breaks when you systemize a relationship business and what gets better? So something goes sideways, some other things go better.
Despite the ask of clients being the same, raising $1 million or $100 million, the fundamental process of implementing that fundraise must be significantly different between the two. And in institutional fundraises, it is about Jeff has a relationship with XYZ VC or private equity or family office or whomever. I pick up the phone and I say, hey, I've got this deal. Take a look at it. I think it's going to fit your portfolio. It's my relationship, right, that I'm bringing to the table. And there's no if, and, or but about that. The issue is transferring that process to an early stage capital raise or even a fund manager fundraise. And I'll give you the abbreviated version. I can give a whole TED talk about this. But the abbreviated version is there's a fundamental misalignment of interests, right? Robin, you hire me to help you raise capital. And then John, and then Mary, and then Susan, and then all of these different companies, right? For an early stage, let's say fundraising round, regardless of what the industry is. Company A hires me, I go to John Smith, the investor. Company B, John Smith, the investor. Company C, John Smith, the investor. And although the company is paying me, my actual relationship that I care about is with the investor, because that's how I'm making money. The companies who are hiring me, retainer or not retainer, I don't really care so much because I know there's going to be another company raising capital. What I care about is where the money's coming from. Because that is more of a unique type of find that you're making. The issue with that is that then I'm protecting my relationship with the investor. And fundamentally, in early stage investing, it is so important for the investor and the founder to have a relationship. And if I'm being a blocker, if I'm creating a Chinese wall between the two, you're doomed from the start. It's just not going to work. Forget about the economics. Just around the like philosophical nature of connecting those two entities, those two stakeholders, founder and investor. An investor must believe not only in the business, but in the founder. And that's
why you think there must be a chemistry there.
It's yeah, of course. Well, it's chemistry, but again, you know, I'm you're asking for $100 million raise. It's because you have performance, you have revenue, you have, let's take outliers aside, of course. Like you have all of these bits and pieces in the business. I don't really care so much about Robin. Robin's proven to me that he can run a successful business. I'm investing in the business. I'm not so much investing in Robin anymore. Now you have a startup that you have no revenue, you have some revenue, you're barely breaking even or making a profitability. It's absolutely, the business is just as important as Robin's leadership. I need to get to know Robin. I need to understand his vision for the future, how he's going to grow the business. Without that, there is no relationship to be had just simply with a business that's barely started or just getting started. So I think that's kind of fundamentally why it's so important. Not to mention the opacity of a lot of advisors in early stage fundraising that throws most people who use advisors completely off. Like I'll joke and say I get a black eye for a fight I was never in going into a lot of our like pitch conversations or pitch calls with potential clients, because they'll say, oh, I worked with an advisor, I paid them 20K, they disappeared for 30 or 60 days. And they said, oh, I didn't get any meetings, nobody was interested in you. And that's wrong. That's not the way to do it. You, especially starting a business, should never rely on any one or even a few people and based on their relationships. You want to control your destiny. And the only way to do that is either running a process by yourself internally based on best practices, go buy an investor list like PitchBook, for example, hire an analyst to sit there and consistently do outreach to qualified and interested investors, or you know, in comes Fiddleman and Company, where we've essentially taken that and created a managed service out of that and give that to our clients.
Now, for those who are not familiar with capital raising in this sense, would you mind give us like the 100,000 foot formula of how this would work? Say a CEO is listening to this right now, they've never done this before, not familiar with the process. You know, how does the arrangement work? What is the cost? Do they get a seat on the board? I don't know what's involved in that minutia there.
In terms of like how we would approach capital raising?
Yeah, how do you approach it and what's the end result deal, I guess?
Sure. So fundraise as a service. Fundamentally, what we do is we have subscribed to a variety of different data sources. PitchBook, Preqin, Fintrix, ZoomInfo for contact enrichment, and just probably a few more that I'm leaving out. We've aggregated all this data internally. And then what we do is we layer an analyst on top of that to do all of the outreach on behalf of our clients. So Alex calls from ABC company or Alex emails from abc.com. And now from the investor's perspective, it's the company that's reached out to them directly, as opposed to a broker, banker, placement agent, or otherwise. And mechanically, how that works is every week, We're pulling about 80 to 100 investor names that we believe are qualified. The analyst is further qualifying each and every single name, personalizing the outreach. So why am I reaching out to Robin, the investor? Well, hi, Robin, this is Alex. I know you're an investor in early stage fintech companies based on your portfolio. We're a payment processing firm raising $1 million. I don't know, something like that, hypothetically speaking. So the personalizations are done. And then effectively, it looks like a marketing outbound campaign. About 2 weeks to 10 days, calls and emails go out to Robin the investor until we can get a hold of him and connect him directly with the founder. Our analysts are not meant to be pitching the business in full. We would be doing a disservice to the founder if we were trying to pitch the business. Our job is more qualification, gaining interest. Think of us as like top of the funnel, and then putting that investor directly in front of the founder to start building that relationship. Every week we share a report with our clients, open reply rates, call connectivity rates, also a list of all of the investors that have engaged, their contact information, their personalization, all of that data that gets spit off of an engagement is our client's data. And then we meet with them once a week as well. My VP of banking, the analyst, the founder, or the management team is on the call to discuss the report, adjust strategy as needed, to discuss the investor calls as well, so that we are better informed now going into the next week to rerun investor lists, to fine tune our criteria of filtering. And also if we need to adjust any of the copy, the subject line, the body of the email that's going out, what the analyst is saying, we have a chance to do that in a much more frequent capacity than trying to do it once a month or once a quarter. So our process, everything that I've just said is exactly reflectant of what you should be doing, you being the founders or managers, whoever out there is listening to this in terms of fundraising. And that's why I'm so transparent about it. Because again, going back to like the whole piece about not doing anything proprietary, we happen to just be able to fragment out the cost of all of this infrastructure across all of our clients. But you can go sign up for PitchBook. It's about $24,000, $25,000 a year, plus or minus. Then you'd hire an analyst, probably because of your own bandwidth issues as a founder, to sit on PitchBook, to qualify the investors that they're going to reach out to create personalization so you're not just spamming email out to all these people, and then pick up the phone and call or email or do a combination of those things.
So you're going to put them through a cadence, right, Jeff?
You put them through a cadence, exactly right. Exactly right. And that's effectively what we do. So that's why I say we've built that infrastructure and then we rent that to our clients month to month. We don't want any of our clients to commit to us for a 6 months or 12 month type of capital raise. I know it might behoove us better to do it that way, but I'd rather our performance speak for itself. That's why we want to have weekly calls with our clients. That's why we want to be accountable for the amount of investor meetings we get for our clients. And that's also kind of most importantly, I often get a question of what is your rate of success? What's your success rate? And it's, you know, I say it a little bit tongue in cheek in that based on what I say we do, our success rate is 100%. 100% of the time, we're able to get our clients in front of interested and qualified investors.
There's a lot of caveats, I'm assuming.
Right. But to say what is my success rate on a third party, Robin, pitching to a fourth party, the investor, on a call that I'm not even on is... it's not a fair question to ask me. I mean, we have statistics of how many of our clients raise capital, all of it, some of it, none of it, and all of that. But what I say we do, again, going back to risk, going back to what we can control, what I can control as a business, as a founder of our own business, is how many calls I can get my clients on, or what is the volume of outreach. I cannot in any way, shape, or form control whether or not someone you speak to is going to give you
money. It sounds to me, Jeff, that this is more of a business process outsourcing, BPO model. It looks like a BPO model.
I mean, I call it a managed service, but it could be a variety of different names. In that case, yeah, I mean, it's very much.
And the question is, at this point, is it core to your business? Can you do it? Do you have the expertise, or do you want somebody on the outside who's established, who's got the cadence, who's got the process to do it on your behalf?
Exactly.
And then as a startup, which you're handling, juggling too many balls up in the air, that's one less thing you don't need to worry about at this point.
Exactly. As a startup or as a fund manager, your job after engaging with us is to show up on calendar meetings that we book for you. We send before the meeting a whole background on who the investor is and the personalizations that we use. And then you show up and you pitch your business.
Do you have any statistics, Jeff, on, I don't know how you measure your business, to be honest with you, business like yours, would it be makes sense to measure it by asset placed, capital invested? How do you measure it?
How we measure it, I'll put it this way. Our goal is to get each of our clients roughly between 1 to 3 net new investor meetings on a weekly basis.
Okay.
So we measure it that way. We do align incentives, right? Going back to incentive alignment, I think this is key to any successful business, is alignment of incentives. not only internally of the business, but interconnected with the client of the business as well. So for example, on our side, all of our analysts, roughly 30% of their compensation is based on filling a quota of how many interested qualified investors they're able to put together with our clients. And the interested and qualified part, by the way, is defined by our client, not by us internally. So there's no like shady business going on. So that's how we're further aligning incentives, in that analysts are incentivized significantly by making sure that they are qualifying, they are doing the proper research, they are doing the proper personalizations before even reaching out to an investor, let alone when they're booking a call with one of our clients and that investor.
So one of the contexts that we've talked about through emails before we booked this podcast, it was the impact of AI and AI, how it creates, somewhat of an operational bottlenecks in relationship-driven fields. Can you comment to the effect of AI in your business?
Yes, I can. And given that we work with so many startups, I would kind of label myself and our business as early adopters, right, of whatever technology is coming out and however we can fold it into our business. And, successes and failures, right? I'll talk about the failure first. About 2 years ago, the process exists for quite some time, and we wanted to increase volume. The thought process was that if we can increase volume in a quality manner, our outcome should be better, right? More investor meetings booked that are qualified, meaning more at bats for our clients, meaning more likely percentage-wise, statistically speaking, for them to close on some capital. So we built an AI that could kind of tear through our CRM based on a client profile, do the qualification or disqualification rather, and then the personalization for every outreach. Efficiency increased 2, 3, 4-fold. I'm not overnight. By the time we built it, implemented, efficiency increased. So from 100, we went to 400 outreaches on a weekly basis. Effectiveness fell through the floor. And what we realized that ended up happening was that analysts would pick up the phone, call an investor. They would read off of the personalization that AI had written for them. And then because they didn't do any research of their own on their own account,
they were not vested into the conversation.
They were not vested. They had no personal conviction and they didn't have anything to talk about. They had something to talk about their company. But they had no idea who they were talking to or why they were talking to them, aside from like, AI told me to talk to you. So we ended up ripping it out. We ended up going back to manual processes. And again, we're very, very good at what we do. And our clients are successful in terms of a lot of them do end up raising capital. Most of them end up raising capital of some sort of degree. All of them get on calls with investors because our analysts now spend 3 minutes, 4 minutes, look at the LinkedIn, look at the socials, look at any blogs look at the website, the corporate website of the VC or family office that's putting this capital forward. So now when an analyst calls, they have conviction. They understand who they're speaking to and why. Mary, I'm reaching out to you because I did all this research on you and you seem like you would be the perfect type of investor for our company, XYZ. So that's kind of, I call it a failure, but we learned a lot from that process. And something that's a success, even now, so, I'll use it a lot to better something that has already been done. So maybe it's copywriting in a deck. Maybe it's not a valuation exercise from scratch, but I'll have it do an overlay on research, making sure that it like triple checks sources, because that also I'm kind of so-so about sometimes. Automating processes on the back end, right? There are a lot of things that, for example, my associate was doing where thankfully AI comes into the picture, because otherwise I would have had to brought an intern in or someone else, because I felt like the value of this associate was in his brain and he was copying like rows from a PDF to a spreadsheet. Let's just call it that. I mean, it was maybe a little bit different than that, but just things that, I jokingly told him, like a monkey could do this, a well-trained monkey could do this. And I said that to him, not in the derogatory way, not in a mean way, but my point to him was that he's so much smarter than doing these menial tasks. Like, we either need to hire an intern or bring somebody on at a much, much lower cost, or let's use Claude, which we ended up doing, so that we can automate or create AI to do this process for you so that you can actually spend time doing what your value is to the business. So I think that's really how more recently we've been implementing AI into the business. It's a lot of like the menial back end tasks that were more like back office or more admin style, that we'll put that off to AI so that the people who do work for the firm, making whatever they're making, can actually, provide that value truly to the firm and to our clients.
And I want to ask you, one of the things that we keep talking about, I just had an AI, I do an AI exchange networking event on Friday morning, If you have somebody on your team who wants to be part of that, you're welcome. And where people from around the globe, they get together and share a few things about what they're working on, what the latest, I guess. Now, I want to get your opinion on what do the investors on the other side receiving, you know, AI-generated material or written decks or whatever they are, and outreach. I mean, I'm seeing people like they're receiving AI phone calls. I don't know how are they perceiving all this? Are they cooperating, hanging up?
Not, but for the most part, not well. And I'll give kind of two anecdotes about this. Number one is using AI to create investor-facing materials. I have no problem with people using it, but it has to be collaborative, right? And at first, when like Gamma came out with all the decks that they were making, and then I forgot the other company's names, but there's one for financial modeling and all of that stuff. Like, it's good to a certain degree. And for some outlier entrepreneurs who have done this, you know, n-teenth times already, it can help them greatly. But if you're a first, second time founder, or frankly, any founder, I would say this advice stands. It's okay to work with AI as long as you know what the output is. And more so, better work with a person that will stress test you or play devil's advocate. Because if you get in front of an investor and show a deck and the investor starts grilling you about that deck, you can't say, I don't know why this is here. AI wrote it for me. I don't
know. You got to take responsibility.
I mean, yeah. And I've seen that happen a few times already in the past year or two, or even more importantly with a financial model, right? Like back in the day, there were all these people selling financial model templates, but then they would come to us saying, hey, Jeff, can you help us fix this before our capital raise? And I would say, no, like I'll build a new one for you. It's going to take me the same amount of time to build you a new model. Then figuring out how this works, stress testing it, and completely ripping it apart and rebuilding it. And something on those lines, like when we build a financial model, before we even build a model, we sit with our client and we discuss, like, how do you think about this business growing? Is it a digital advertising process on how you're getting clients? Is it SDR, BDRs that you're setting quotas for? How do you actually think about the business growing? And then that's what you build a model around. Even the variables that go into that model, let's have a thoughtful conversation on what you think your conversion rates are. Is it based on historical? Is it based on, let's do market research and then we'll put some sourcing against it. But just having a model and then also presenting that to an investor, investor is going to want you to walk them through the model. And if you don't understand,
you better understand it.
Right? Like you don't have to be an Excel genius. You don't have to build the Excel on your own. If you need to hire somebody, you do that. But you need to understand fundamentally as a founder, whoever you are presenting a model or whatever you're presenting, you need to understand how it works and why whatever is in that document that you're presenting, why it's in there.
You know, in the localization industry where, you know, I lived all my life and worked all my life, the debate is always on. And it's been on for, I don't know, 20 years or something. This is nothing new. AI accelerated, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But the debate between human and machine has been going on for many years. You know, do you use typewriter or do you actually handwrite stuff? Back in the days, that's how it was. And now we're talking about completely different things. And, you know, defining the value of the human, it's very important now than more than ever. Because as you said earlier, peel off the processes that you can peel off with less, you know, worries as, you know, as what is the impact of peeling off that process to a machine, be it AI in this case. And the judgment part, the value part that you bring in as an individual, that I bring in as an individual to whatever conversation I'm involved in, that cannot be outsourced. And if I do outsource it, I'm 100% going to take responsibility for it. As you said earlier, the worst excuse you can come, that, you know, it's equivalent to, sorry, professor, the dog ate my homework. Yeah. It's not really the technology's fault. And I keep saying on this channel, we are in charge of technology, not the other way around. Yes. And so what the lazy way of doing it, and I've seen many people do this, many companies do this, but you know what? We deployed AI, we gave it to our team, and the doodle hit the fan. Why? It's because nobody was trained on it. Nobody was actually told where and how to use it. And people went willy-nilly with this. If given the choice, a human always chooses the lazy way out.
Yeah, it's well, that's why most people are not entrepreneurs, right? It's really, really, really hard. If it was easy, everybody would do it. And to your point on that, I I've had this conversation internally as well occasionally. It's if you send an email, it does not matter who is responsible for the content of the email. You are responsible for the content of the email. If your name is on the email and you click send, I don't care if another analyst puts together a deck and sent it to you, or AI put together the email and sent it to you. It is your responsibility. You are fully responsible for what there is. Anyone delivering something to a client, or even, again, sending an email, the content of the email, regardless of who put it together, is your responsibility because you clicked send.
Yeah, your name is on the email.
Exactly.
I mean, how can
you... It sounds obvious, Robin. I know it sounds obvious, but it isn't. I'll put it that way.
The other part of it is, in many industries, including your industry, the capital raising, fundraising industry, and investor attraction is going through right now, is that you've got the same tools available to everybody. So these models are available to pretty much everybody. And you take, for instance, a recruiter, right? So here's a recruiter, you want to hire somebody. The recruiter goes out to AI, generate a good job ad, puts it out there. The candidates do the same thing. They take the job ad, they put it into AI, they craft a nice package of CVs, cover letter, references, etc., and they push it out to the recruiter. And I'm imagining in my mind, you've got two bots, one on the recruiting side, one on the candidate side. They're duking it out. And the two individuals are sitting on Starbucks sipping coffee. Why I have that image playing in my head, I have no idea. But in your world, you've got, I want to say everybody's using the AI tools. Some of them are different than the other. But for the majority, they're using AI tools to write decks, to create content. The same investor, if he's receiving emails or pitches from two different analysts, from two different companies or three different analysts, if they are using the same tools, that's going to become repetitive. It's going to be annoying. These guys that don't want to invest anymore say, enough with this. It's causing frustration, I think. I don't know the answer to that. Is that true?
Absolutely. It is. We've heard that from a lot of investors in our network that we speak to. It is causing a lot of frustration. And again, going back to my point earlier, I believe that AI is a supplemental tool for a lot of what we've been discussing today, and not a replacement tool. And it's funny that you bring that up. I was just speaking with my colleague about joining a call, and now everyone has like a note taker. We use Fireflies, but everyone has like Zoom, Otter, Fathom, Granola, whatever, right? Like your flavor of choice. And we were joking that pretty soon, like we're just going to sit back with cameras off on the Zoom and the AIs will just talk to each other. And then we won't even have to be on the calls. The AIs would just talk to each other. And you know, there's some truth in that. And that conversation has been getting brought up a lot over the past weeks, months. I believe that the pendulum always swings. I know that there are tools being worked on for quite some time, and even more so now for verification of humanity, right? It's one thing to like do the hand in front of the face to make sure you're not an AI bot. But eventually, I believe where we'll head is if you remember Twitter, like blue check marks or something, or LinkedIn verification, you can like scan your license or your ID now to verify that you're a real person. They'll have something like that pretty soon. And where that goes eventually, I mean, look, if you want to go like super sci-fi, the reality is that every time there's a lock built, there's a key that breaks the lock. Every time there's a key that's built that breaks that lock, you build a harder lock, right? And so on. That's human innovation, right? Most people talk about shields and bombs, right? You build a bomb and then you build a shield to protect against it. And there's a bigger bomb and there's a bigger shield and so on and so forth. So do we get to a point where like there's a little blood marker on your laptop when you sign in to actually verify that you are in fact a human? Maybe, like a Gattaca type of situation. If whoever's seen the movie, but it's an older movie, perhaps we get to that point. I mean, they often say, if you want to see what the future looks like, you read sci-fi or you watch a sci-fi movie. And I think we will get there. And it goes exactly to your point, Robin. I think this is a really cool tool. I think there's going to be a lot of adoption to it. I think people want people. Like, I think for some things, it's okay to be an AI bot. Like nowadays, I prefer if I have an issue with a product that I buy or some sort of software that we use, I'd rather talk to the little like chat bot in the corner of the screen. It usually helps me resolve my issue. But for business, for interactions, for what you started this podcast out with, relationship business, at least in my mind, for the foreseeable future, will not be handed off to AI. So that's why a lot of these AI companies, we have a lot of clients that will come to us after using one of those AI fundraising tools and tell us that it didn't work. And it doesn't, it no longer surprises me, because you start spamming these messages out, you burn your domain name, you burn your own name from a reputational
perspective. For sure, you burn your reputation.
Yeah, and it only goes so far. So I think, again, like AI is great help, but look at it as help and not a full replacement to any process whatsoever.
How do you handle security, privacy, confidentiality in an AI environment? I interviewed somebody yesterday, Yagob Rahimov. He's from Austin, Texas. They got this AI company that works on, you were talking about fake detection, it's called. And the key there is they managed to miniaturize AI as a small language model to be put in on any device, from your watch to your you know, security camera, etc. And the job there is to learn the context of the individual themselves, learn what they're capable of, and prevent, you know, from a security perspective, people mimicking you or try to understand your behavioral patterns, etc., and therefore break it into the system. As you know, 99% of hacks are caused by human, not necessarily somebody penetrated a firewall, for instance, and did malicious activities. Somebody handed the key to the castle, basically. In your opinion, especially with SOC 2 and a bunch of other, and I'm assuming you have all the security standards in place, how do you put guardrails around all this?
I don't know if you're going to like my answer or if anybody else. You just have to be careful. Like, think twice, think three times. If something seems out of the blue, it probably is in today's data and environment. And again, there's, as much as people hate for some reason picking up the phone and calling, you can always pick up the phone and call someone. And I think that's, for now at least, a good format of verification. Of course, you know, a number could be spoofed. You can have AI in the other line. It's not even the right person. So think four times before you effectuate a transaction, before you give your security key up, before you, you know, get a random password request or a login attempt. I mean, the amount, like I probably, you as well, but the amount of times I get per day, like some sort of access request or password change request, or, you know, we found tax, either liability for you, or we found a tax refund for you, or a law firm earlier today texted me that, you know, your name has come up in this lawsuit that you actually won and you didn't know about. And this takes me back to like the Kenyan prince or princess saying that, you know, I have undeclared funds or something like that. And it's just like, it always will prey on people who are desperate.
For sure.
And in that, and perhaps this is a life philosophy that I've learned over time, certainly not instilled in me as a child, but anytime you do something out of desperation, it's usually not going to end well.
It's the wrong move.
Yeah, it's the wrong move. If you're desperate because there's someone wanting to send you money and your family background came up somewhere in Europe and you're actually a prince. Like, if you're desperate, you want this to happen and you want it so much that you believe it to be true. But it more often than not, I mean, I don't want to, again, I never say never, right? But anything done out of desperation is most often the wrong decision to be.
If you don't mind, for those who are listening to this and they're thinking, I wonder what the funding climate look like right now. Can you give them a general idea? Is there money available for good ideas or existing companies, et cetera? And what are investors interested in funding? You know, what's the hottest topic that they like to invest in right now?
Short answer is yes, there's money available for funding. I think the availability of capital for funding is actually only increasing now. Both, you know, today was the SpaceX IPO, but there's been a ton of liquidity events that people have seen through companies, through private equity funds, through other venture funds that they've enjoyed liquidity now. I'd say, you know, ever since about June or July of 2025 last year, about a year ago now, there's been a steady increase in liquidity in the market available for companies. Now, the caveat that I would say is that an early round, like a seed stage round, or investors are typically looking for $500,000 to $1 million in revenue. So the dynamics and the labeling of these rounds and stages no longer apply to what the labels meant 10, 15 years ago when they initially started. A seed investor is typically looking for $500,000 to $1 million in revenue. Not all, but almost all of the investors that our clients have been speaking with. I think in the same lines with AI, now kind of looping both of those together, with the advent of all of these vibe coding tools, it's no longer acceptable to be raising, you know, $100,000, $200,000 for a pre-seed round in order to develop a business. So I can hire an engineer and put together a product or a proof of concept or an MVP, right? I've built, just anecdotally, two or three products spending a few hundred dollars and maybe a few hundred hours on Lovable, just to give an example. And it works. It works enough. And I've had clients who've built a product on Lovable as an extension of their business and have had 50 to 100 clients, paying customers that came to their platform. And by the way, they have absolutely no technical background or engineering, but they were able to do it. Now, on a longer term basis, you know, AI tools are getting better. You probably need to bring on like a developer or development team to actually get you to proper scale. But the dynamics of fundraising have changed in the way that seed investors are looking for revenue, significant revenue. I would say $500 to $1 million is already significant when you're starting from zero. And even pre-seed investors are looking at founders that are developing, you know, software companies that they should have spent the time to put together an MVP. And I would say, like, there are outliers to what I'm saying, right? Deep tech, quantum technology, developing some sort of pharmaceutical drug, right? Those need a significant amount of capital before you're actually able to monetize and show revenue. So take those businesses aside. But by and large, if I'm looking at the center of the bell curve, yes, there's money available. And that's why building that relationship with an investor, showing passion for what you do, showing that investor that, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to be the person to lead this company through profitability, through revenue generation, through implementation and go to market. That's what the investor wants to hear.
Yeah, they don't want to throw their money on hopes and prayers.
Absolutely.
They want to get that confidence from the owner or the idea person that this gonna they're gonna see this through the light.
Right. Exactly.
Now, what I was gonna ask is on the fundraising and capital raising. A lot of people are apprehensive about this, and as you know, as you mentioned Lovable earlier, any idea can be developed now, and the investors know that, and the people with the ideas know that. So, with a few hundred dollars, they put an idea together. And that perhaps the missing piece is not to develop the idea, is to commercialize the idea. Has commercialization gotten into the equation? So I've got an idea, it's built, it's ready to go. I just need marketing dollars, or I need sales infrastructure dollars. Does that get into it, or no? It just, they want to develop the idea as an asset.
You know, that is a good question. I hate to say it depends. So I won't lead with it depends.
That's okay.
I think almost any business can reach commercialization with a couple of clients based on founder-led sales. Now, if it's a totally nascent business that the founders have no experience or background in, that obviously becomes a much bigger task and bigger lift. By and large, what I have seen, especially in entrepreneurs and founders, especially in early stage companies, they typically have some sort of tie to whatever product it is that they're building. And that tie could be from where they worked before or product knowledge or being around the product, or maybe coming out of necessity where, you know, some of the best products are founded on necessity. Like I was trying to do something, I couldn't do it. So I invented this widget or this software to enable me to better do whatever it is that I'm doing. And I think in that case, there's always the ability to do guerrilla marketing, to do sales, to do, you know, knock on random doors down your block. Like, I mean, I'm being a bit facetious here, but one of the most powerful sales tools that we have had for decades. And for some reason, maybe post-COVID, maybe because of texting, maybe because of AI, maybe because of whatever the case may be, people don't use it. And it's constantly in our hands.
It's phony.
And we're just not picking up the phone and talking to people. And it seems like an uphill battle. It seems like I'm talking about like Wolf of Wall Street or Boiler Room or any one of those things where you're like, pick up the phone and call. But you're not only going to get so much feedback from people that you're calling, maybe you'll get a client. Maybe you don't get a client and you know, somebody hangs up on you. Maybe by the 100th call, they're telling you what's wrong with what you're doing and what would it take for them to become a client. But there's no one that I know that has become successful in building a business that did it because they launched the business online, did some good SEO, and then made a ton.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we struggle with as inventors, especially nowadays, because we've gotten used to the convenience of things. You know, if you put a good app together, and definition of good app is very fluid, I guess. If you put a good app together and, you know, build it and they come, and that scares me, to be honest with you, because we've witnessed in the 90s and the late 90s, early 2000s, that didn't work. Build it and they come. No, you have to produce revenue. You got to have real customers. You've got to have a balance sheet. You got to get the foundation of the business going at some point. And that's going to take some elbow grease. And it's not about downloading an app from the Apple store and get it going on your phone and all of a sudden you got a business. I wish it was that easy. Maybe it would be that easy down the road, but there is still some effort that an entrepreneur needs to do. I was actually talking to somebody yesterday from, I think it was Atlanta, Georgia. We're talking about it coincidentally. We're talking about it from a point of, they developed something, they're looking for some VC money and they want to try to pitch it out. And there's another issue altogether with some of the ideas being generated out there. Do you want to have a niche idea? Or do you want to have a horizontal idea? Do you want to have a multi-industry idea that goes across to broader, wider audience of buyers? Or do you want to have a very pointed app or idea that you want to try to sell to somebody who is like, maybe you can count them on one hand. I'm also reminded back in the telecom days, Nortel had developed a piece of gear, and I sold the test bed for that one. It was quite expensive, millions of dollars. And I was wondering, like, what are they going to do with this? And I stayed in touch with them. The VP Business Development is a good friend of mine. And they ended up, after they put it together, they ended up going to do a pitch for a customer, one of our largest customers in Canada. You probably know them. The largest telecom company in Canada. And I said to him after the meeting, I said, so how did it go? He said, Robin, here's what they told us. You mean to tell me with one of those devices, I'll put it in Winnipeg for those of you who are from outside the country. It's a central town in the middle of the country. Geographically, it's the center of the country. And with its third of its capacity, I can handle the entire internet traffic of the entire country. So the question was from the customer, how many of those are you going to sell? So fundamentally, when you build something because you can, or it looks good, or it feels cool. I don't know if it's cool to everybody. Maybe it's cool to you. The point of evaluating the idea, and I see a lot of those, they get excited about the idea, they push it out there, and immediately my commercialization head gets in. I'm thinking, like, how many of those are you going to sell? Who are you going to sell it to? Have you defined your ICP? And all that stuff is still missing.
Yes, yes. It's don't build in a silo. Don't wait for, you know, perfection is the enemy of done, as the saying goes. Don't wait until you have a fully done product in order to go to market. I mean, it's one thing to do soft launch, hard launch. I hear all these variations of it, but build publicly. As you're building, get customer feedback. As you're building, reach out to people to understand how they would use it. And it's, look, one person gives you a point of feedback. I'm not saying take one person and then adjust it. But speak to 10 people. If 7 out of 10 people give you the same point of feedback, maybe take it into consideration because it's important. And it's the same thing in this case, right? Like, and even with that, maybe it's not a bad business to build. Maybe they spent millions of dollars developing this one thing that's going to cover the entire country of Canada. But then that's not their monetization. Their monetization is maybe on the traffic that feeds through this system that goes through the entire country of Canada, or feeds telecom to the country of Canada, right? Like, it's oftentimes, you know, like when men plans, God laughs. Same thing with business. In every case, even with us building this operating system with Fundex, I'm glad that it took us so long to build it, because as we were building it, as we were stress testing it, as our analysts were using it, as we were talking about it with stakeholders and potential clients, there was so much amazing feedback that we got that did materially impact how we were developing, how we were pricing, how we were positioning the platform. And that always happens, right? Like, I started this business 11 years ago in 2015. It certainly looks different today than it did 11 years ago. And you know, you probably start by saying yes to everyone and then asking them what the question is. And that's definitely what I did, at least anecdotally.
That's the story of the entrepreneur.
Right. That's sure. You know, 2015, 2016, 2017, I said, yes, now what's the question? I'll figure out how to do it.
That's right.
Now, fast forward, we do this one thing. We're really, really, really good at what we do. We will not do anything outside of that. Because we've optimized this engine, this product, this managed service, this BPO, whatever anybody wants to call it, we're really good at doing that. And doing anything outside of that is just taking bandwidth away from the core business. And we don't want to do that.
Truly. Well, look, I mean, we're up to time here. And I really appreciate the conversation. I'm having so much fun with this. But I do want to ask you a couple questions before we get into the rapid fire. I got a few rapid fire questions for you. Have we covered everything you wanted to cover in this podcast?
I think so. Yeah.
Is there any other area of interest? I'm sorry?
I said, it's your show. I'll throw the same question back at you.
So I think one of the only, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, wants to reach out to you listening to this podcast, what is the easiest way to get a hold of you?
Email is going to be easiest. It's my first name, jeffrey@fiddlemanco.com. That's also our domain. If anybody wants to check out the website, it's fiddlemanco.
And for the audience, if you're interested in this conversation and you like to talk to Jeff, please reach out to me. If you can't find Jeff on LinkedIn, I'll be happy to make an introduction. I've done this before with all of our guests, and I continue to do that. I'll be happy to facilitate an intro. Also, I want to thank, before we get into the wrapping up of this, I've got a few rapid fire questions, if you don't mind, Jeff. One is, what is the most overrated fundraising advice you hear constantly? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No.
Sounds like a Jeopardy question.
Yeah. A lot of people talk about be careful who you take money from. I think there is definitely some merit in that. At the same time, you know, it depends. I'll put it this way. Somebody once told me that once you agree on a price, that's when the negotiation starts. And it's nothing has been truer than that when it comes to making a deal happen or a transaction happen. That being said, if you're materially trying to grow the business, it's your first business especially, and you're running out of options.
Yep.
unless there's egregious terms tied to it. Don't say, I only want to take money from Strategic, or I only want to take money from Andreessen Horowitz, otherwise I'm not going to take money from anyone else. Well, guess what? If you're not going to take money from anyone else, your business is going to fail and you're going to run out of options and run out of time. So it's a measured approach. I don't think that there's no blanket saying that applies to every situation. I think maybe I'll go with that one. There's no one thing I can say now that will apply to every single situation. It's highly situational dependent, and I'll kind of leave it at that.
Cold outreach or warm introduction 10 years from now, which one is dead?
Neither. No way. I think warm outreach is always the best. And we do cold outreach almost exclusively. I still say warm outreach is always going to be the best way. If somebody can introduce you to a funding source, that will always be your best path to getting capital. That being said, cold outreach works. I mean, I've built several businesses doing it. And I think if anything, now people are afraid to pick up the phone and do the outbound call. I can't tell you how many investors or analysts call that will talk to the founder and say, like, holy smokes, you actually picked up the phone and called me. Nobody's done that
in
10 years, you know, and they're really happy about that. So I think cold outreach will be here to stay for the long
term. The last question, Jeff, one AI tool your team genuinely cannot live without?
Fireflies. Oh, that's an easy one. And it's not even part of the AI piece. It's just the transcriber and the recorder. The amount of times that she said, this said, that said, and I'll bring up the recorder and that's why we have it on there. So
absolutely.
Always speak as if you're being recorded. And then to the extent possible, just record yourself just in case.
I really appreciate your time, Jeff.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me.
No, I really appreciate it. That was a fun conversation. And we haven't had one of those conversations for a while now. And it's kind of put it back into perspective, that whole venture capital, you know, and I'd love to do another one. If you know of anybody that you can recommend for this podcast on private equity and how do they work from a funding perspective, if you've got any connection. Would love an introduction.
I'd like a few introductions,
And I'd love to have another conversation on the PE side. I really appreciate the guest that we had today, Jeffrey Fidelman. I really appreciate his time and the amount of effort that he puts in these podcasts and sharing his story on various podcasts, specifically this one today. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining us on YouTube. If you're watching us on YouTube, thanks for watching. If you're coming in on our audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're checking out our blog where I summarize these conversations into an archivable form, please check them out. And thanks so much for sharing and commenting on them. RobinAyoub.blog, you can look up previous episode. You can check out the episode here with Jeff on the blog as well. So I want to thank everybody. I wish everybody happy Friday afternoon and good weekend. And I will see you guys at the next episode. Thank you so much.